Thanks to our show sponsor, Out West Buildings in Fallon. If you're anything like me, you've gotten the enough is enough speech from your significant other. Before you go out and do something foolish this season, get in touch with my guy, Irvin. He's got plenty of man cave options to protect those priceless mounts and might even help save your marriage along the way. Just go to outwestbuildings.com. Out West Buildings doesn't build sheds, they solve space problems. There he is, right there. Take him. Hey, thanks for joining us on Nevada Backcountry this Sunday. It's going to be a jam-packed show. We had a plan, and like any good plan, it sounded good in theory until we got hit in the face. And the punch in the face this morning was shed hunting. We were going to cover some tag application stuff, getting out, doing some scouting. We got talking off air about shed hunting. It's a big point of contention right now. Nevada has established a shed hunting season. You have to have a certificate to do it. I come down on one side of this, but after discussing it with David, I see where I might have been wrong on something. We'll talk about that a little bit. David, give me the 40,000-foot overview on shed hunting and why Nevada kind of had its hand forced and had to establish a season for this.
Well, yeah, so I'm not sure if it was hand forced, but there's a closed season, which is January 1 through April 30th in quite a few of the counties in the state where you cannot pick up any sheds. The season actually begins May 1st
through June 30th.
June 30th.
Yeah.
A lot of this is, you know, the shed hunting back in the day was just kind of a fun thing you did when you were out chasing chucker, trying to do some chucker hunting. You'd come across a nice shed, you'd pick it up, throw it in your backpack. And over the years, it's become this industry. You'll see pictures online of some of these shed hunting groups and teams that they'll have, you know, 2-3 pickup truck beds full of sheds just stacked to the rim. You know, the sheds get sold to furniture companies for chandeliers and for miscellaneous things.
You had mentioned like selling to the Chinese for medicinal stuff or something? Like
the medical market, you know, they sell them to some of these vendors. They grind them up and use the powders and stuff for certain medicines and medicinal purposes. There's a pretty good market for the sheds. Well, that has brought in gobs of people to go in and just basically annihilate some of these canyons with shed hunters.
And that's such a critical time for animals, too, and herds to kind of recover. January 1 through April 30th is generally when they're reforming herds and they're just coming off being extremely pressured all
hunting.
Well,
you got to give them a break. I mean, right. You know, you go from hunting season to bird season, then you're going to start going into shed season. So, you know, there's a point in time where you got to give these poor animals a break on the landscape and quit pressuring them and quit running them all over the place. The season kind of gives them a break. Also, one of the big issues, this is me personally, is some of these shed hunting groups, they just have no regard for the habitat. You've got your spotter up on the mountain with the binoculars and the spotting scope radioing into the person on the ATV or the UTV, telling them, hey, I got a shed, it's on the mountain here, and they're going up and down these hills in their machines. I mean, they're just crushing brush and breaking trails, and not all of them, so don't start sending comments and stuff and just getting all pissed off at me, but I've actually witnessed this on a few occasions where they're just driving those dang machines straight up to the shed, grabbing it, and then their spotter on the mountain saying, okay, there's another one 300 yards to the right. Just head over that way.
As we're talking here, I just out of curiosity, I Googled shed hunting. You're right. This is something that wasn't even on my radar. Even I hate to spotlight anybody, especially somebody who I admire, I think has done a lot for the hunting community. But even Steve Ranella has a perfect conditions for shed hunting blog post on the Meat Eater website. And to me, shed hunting was always something I did with my kids. it was a fun activity. You go out, you hike around, maybe you find a couple, like a hunter's Easter egg hunt. Or chucker season was another big one. Once I switch gears from big game, I'm out chucker hunting. Like you said, yay, I might find one, two during a day, pick them up, throw them in my bird vest, and cool, it goes on the mantle at home. But as soon as I Googled this, I mean, website after website after website on strategizing for shed, the whole concept seems foreign to me. But now that we bring that up, someone pointed out to me that Nevada now has a shed season. You have to get a certificate.
Yeah, which is just an online. You just get online and you go through the mini course and then you get your shed hunting certificate. It's nothing super formal. It's just, as it's transitioned into more of an industry and less of a family or outing activity, you know, I used to do it all the time because I would go out in that May, June, well, most likely June, July period when I was looking for new areas and scouting for deer, elk, and what have you. And I'd be out there and hiking around. And there'd be maybe a few times where I'd be focusing on looking for sheds, but most of the time it was like accidental coming across them and like, oh, cool, man. Nice little 5-point bull here. All right, cool. Strap it on my pack and continue my scouting. But as it's transitioned into this more commercial activity, you're putting them on the market and you're selling them. And they do bring some significant money, especially if you get some really nice browns. You don't want the chalky ones and stuff. Those are generally sold to folks who grind them up and use them for other purposes. But the really nice fresh browns, they can go for some good money in the furniture industry for all kinds of products.
I just saw a hit. A guy made $176,000 last year shed hunting. That just blows my mind. And like anything, I could see you put a financial incentive on doing it. Suddenly it becomes...
it's a side hustle.
A side hustle, right. And I've heard statistics before. I remember hearing at one point that essentially in that critical post-hunt time when animals are kind of regrouping, you have 80% of the animals and 20% of the habitat. They tend to congregate in the same areas. So yeah, I could see how you could blow them out of a traditional wintering range or whatever. You're scattering animals leads to lower survivability.
And it's not only just blowing them out of the area, it's the stressor. I mean, right. You're constantly stressing these poor animals as you're cruising around in the ATV. And I've got nothing against shed hunting. I've always enjoyed it. It's been a very low-cost, enjoyable activity, cruising around out in the hills and learning new country or seeing country you haven't seen in a while and getting back in there to check it out.
That time, too, with tag applications starting in mid-March, that end of chucker season, you know, going up to the end of January, used to be my time to, I could see some new country, check out, you know, am I seeing good deer in this area, et cetera, et cetera. It kind of separates those two. Now I know, okay, I'm not going to pick up sheds while I'm out there, quote unquote, scouting or crossing off areas that maybe I'm not going to apply in. For people listening, if you are one of those casual shed hunters that wants to go out, pick up a few sheds, you need to do the online certification for it. That is our new reality in Nevada.
Nevada's just been considered a really good shed hunting state. So some of the bigger groups that are actually doing this as a pretty significant side hustle, like the guy that made 100K plus.
176,000, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know, they're going to seek out some of the best locations for acquiring as many antlers as they can in the shortest amount of time. So, and there's plenty of counties in the state where generally going after the elk.
Right.
Biggest bang for your buck, finding a nice big old 6-point rack.
After that sidebar there, we will get into upcoming tag applications. A little bit of 3D season prep. Indoor archery season is coming to an end. And then we'll discuss some of the new fads in arrows, pick David's brain on what the kind of standard diameter arrows are. Stay tuned to 99.1 and 92.3 FM Talk.
And we're back here on Nevada Backcountry with Henry and myself. In this segment, we are going to talk about getting ready for the tag application season here coming up. For Nevada, we're going to be looking at the application starting here in,
Mid-March.
We've got a couple cool little things that we've been kind of throwing back and forth to each other and having our conversations that we generally do. Some things that you could be really thinking about right now and prepping yourself before the books start coming out, where you start really digging into those, is evaluating the points. How many points you have for each species in whatever states that you're putting in for. Determine what are your best odds or chance of drawing a tag based on your points.
Going into it with a strategy, I think, is the best way to summarize it. You know, make sure that financially you have a budget, and more importantly almost is a time budget. I had a year where it seemed like everything we put in for, we drew, and we found ourselves, and by we, I mean my dad and I, found ourselves in a situation where, you know, hey, I can only dedicate 4 days to this antelope hunt. Then we're driving 14 plus hours to New Mexico. Then we're switching gears. We can't do the whole thing in New Mexico. We got to switch gears and do this hunt in Nevada. So go into it with a strategy. Make sure you know, okay, I have X amount of points for this. I'm most likely to draw this. I might have to turn something back in the state of Nevada if I draw out of state. Now, they kind of stagger the tag draw dates so that you kind of know, okay, I have this hunt I'm going on. But that's the biggest thing, is don't spread yourself too thin and make sure you know what you're getting into. Have a plan.
Yeah, and you know, really know, do you want a high quality hunt or do you want quantity? Do you want the opportunity? So I'm in a situation right now where I've got a lot of points for my California bighorn and then my elk and antelope, as well as my points for Utah. So it's like, do I go ahead and put in for everything and just hope I get something, or do I strategize it a little bit and decide to put in for points for certain animals and then focus on, say, my antelope hunt or my mule deer, because I've got so many points, I've got a really good chance of getting a really good area and a high quality hunt out of it. Last thing I want to do personally is end up drawing an elk tag out of state at $1,000 or more and then realize, oh man, I just drew that tag I really want. And now I've got to turn in my out of state elk tag and now I'm out $1,000 because they don't refund you your money.
That's what you said.
Yeah, you got to strategize or swing for the fence and put in for an area that's just super coveted, like, you know, the Grand Canyon bison hunt. That's probably one of the most coveted tags in the country. So go for it. And if you get it, well, then everything else drops off the table. And you just got to strategize. You got to know what are you really focusing on for the year? And then do your research. A lot of the states have your draw odds. You know, you can go onto their websites, get under their hunting application or their hunting portion of their website, and they'll have your draw odds, the success in each area.
Use the information that's out there on apps, on state-run websites, and use that stuff to know what you are applying for, know what your odds are that you're going to get it, or as close as you can be to figuring out what your odds are. I don't know off the top of my head what Western states, where it's basically like, if you draw it, you bought it, you're out the money. We should probably do a little research on that. I know Nevada makes it pretty convenient with the turn-in system, but not all states are like that. And you need to know before you go and jump in and do this stuff, make sure you know what you're checking out with. Learn from my mistakes or my family's mistakes, for sure, because there have been years where, you know, we get drawn for a tag and we're all sitting around looking at each other going, I didn't put in for that. Hold on, pull this up. What an archery tag. Oh, it was my fifth choice. A lot of people treat those fourth and fifth choices as throwaways, or they just put something on there to put something on there. Well, then come summertime, you go, oh, I drew a muzzle. I don't even own a muzzle loader. Why do I have a muzzleloader tag now? Why did I put in for that? So you need to make sure before you check out, go, okay, let me double check this and make sure I don't draw something that I don't want and I burn points on, or something that I'm not necessarily prepared to go on the hunt.
And on that note, you know, understand the draw system of the state that you're putting in for, because even though you're putting in for your fifth choice, that doesn't mean that unlikely you're going to draw that tag because you have four choices above that. Again, when we talked about this a couple weeks ago on like Nevada's draw cycle, your fifth choice, depending on the number that you pull for that particular draw species, your fifth choice may end up being the only tag that's available.
Right.
So you've got to be careful with that, because that we see it every year at some of the archery ranges and the shops. People come walking in, you know, 3 weeks before the hunt going, hey, I pulled an antelope archery tag. It was my fourth or fifth choice. I need to buy a bow.
Yeah.
And granted, you know, shops love people like that because.
Cha-ching.
Yeah. On the same note, though, it's like, well, you might want to practice a bit.
Yeah. You want to know, okay, if I draw this, am I going to be sick? Have I set myself up for success? Because there's a lot of off-season stuff that goes into being prepared for that hunt. To switch gears a little bit, David, top three, what are you looking for this year with the applications?
I am looking for, as I start my research right now, my draw tags for right now, I'm going to be focusing this year on bull elk.
Okay.
I've got a lot of points for bull elk. My son's got a lot of points for bull elk. So that's going to be the focus. So from there, I'm going to go in and I'm going to find out some of the big things that you want to find out, the quality of the habitat for the year. I mean, there's like three major components I look at when I'm trying to figure out where to hunt for a specific animal is quality of the animal, you know, big rack on them, genetics, age, and the quality of the habitat and the food. Well, there's nothing, we can't do anything about genetics and age.
No.
Okay. That is what it is. What you can figure out is the habitat and the food source. If an area is in a really nasty drought cycle, your antler growth is probably not going to be all that fantastic. You know, even though it's been great in the past, it might not be so great this year because they've had 2 or 3 years of drought. So I look into some of that stuff, like the water quality and some of the habitat conditions of some of these spots. So for me, like this year, I'm going to be focusing again, like I said, on elk. Got three spots in the state of Nevada and two in Utah that I will be most likely putting in for, because we've had great winters this year. Green up's probably going to be really solid, hopefully. Antler growth is going to be good, and hopefully I can pull the tag. And then on the other side of that is my next one is going to be my antelope. You know, I've got quite a few points for antelope. Me, my wife, and my son all have quite a few points for antelope. So I'll be focusing on information that the states provide in relation to success in these areas. Granted, a lot of places don't have, you know, they don't have the scores of the antelope to give you guidance. But, you know, through the grapevine, you can, you know where the good spots are and where some of the bruisers are cruising around. So that's kind of my focus for this year.
Okay, elk, antelope, and what would be a third?
My third would be my mule deer.
Mule deer,
yeah.
Okay.
I don't have that many points for it, but, you know, with archery, I generally go into the mule deer hunt. I'm not a big trophy hunter. I did that for a few years, and I just realized that that's not me. I like the pursuit. I love the stalk and the pursuit of the animal, and it really drives me nuts when I was letting some really nice animals go by because there was that one animal I saw.
Had to have
on day one or two, and then I spend the next 5, 6, 7 days trying to find that dang thing again, and I keep past. So mule deer is generally, I've got a few spots that I generally have a really, really good chance of pulling a tag and having a really good time with my son hiking into the backcountry or just tooling around.
Gotcha. One thing, when you bring up the food sources and everything, another component that I look at is the feral horse population.
Oh, my God.
And without getting into a, you know, that's an episode in and of itself, but I know specifically right now historically a very good unit for trophy bulls, it's been absolutely decimated by feral horses. There was a bunch of crested wheat to support the elk population in that area. And there's just no management being done for the feral horses. Again, I don't want to get too far off the rails with it, but they will turn an entire field of crested wheat into a dust bowl in no time.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Before we go to break here, we have a Mountain Tough Plus, the full suite, so you get a year of access to every Mountain Tough fitness program they've created. This is a perfect opportunity for one lucky listener to win this. David has graciously donated it. To enter, all you've got to do is like, subscribe on Facebook. Diving right back into it here. First, I wanted to thank Out West Buildings out of Fallon for sponsoring the show. They don't just build sheds, they solve space problems. As you guys know, if you've been listening to the show, we're coming to the end of indoor target archery season and coming into the summer or spring and summer 3D season for archery. Most of us shoot these lot bigger arrows, a size 23, size 27 for indoor.
Boys.
Yeah, the fat boys. You know, not the best choice for outdoor 3D season. So, David, let's talk a little bit about getting your bow set up or getting set up in general for outdoor target season.
As you're transitioning from the indoor season and you're shooting, depending on what competition you're shooting, if you're shooting USA tournaments, you can't have anything larger than a 23 arrow. If you're going into NFAA, you can go up to a 27. Now, there are a lot of competitions, like the ASA tournament series, which is Midwest and slowly working their way. It's East Coast, Midwest, and slowly working to the West Coast is the ASA-style outdoor tournaments. And indoor tournaments. They have indoor 3D shoots as well. Those primarily shoot 23s.
And for those that don't know, when we say 23 or 27, what we're referring to is the diameter of the arrow. If you've never seen a size 27 arrow, you can look them up online, but it's basically a much thicker arrow. And the intent or the design philosophy behind that is a larger diameter arrow, you are much more likely to catch a line on a target, thus scoring higher. So if this isn't something on your radar, you probably thought arrow shafts were all the same size. They are not. There is a specific much larger diameter shaft for indoor target archery.
I'm training a youngster right now with bare bow, and her father handed her a bunch of his arrows. It's like, hey, shoot these are fine. Arrows are arrows.
This is what I got.
Yeah, this is what I got. You're good to go. And we were training, and I'm watching her arrow flight, and I'm like, my God, it's like she's shooting 2x4s. I mean, she's shooting a 22-pound recurve, and her father's got a 55-pound recurve. So she's shooting a very heavy spined arrow, and when it comes out of the bow, it's out of control. It's too heavy. So anyway, so yeah, that's going on to understanding arrows. So as we're moving into the 3D season, we in the community, we say, oh, it's time to start getting into our skinnies. So what that is, are just a smaller diameter arrow. It's usually, depending on the type of 3D or what you prefer, I shoot a 19 diameter Easton ACG arrow. It's a aluminum arrow woven over with carbon. You can get all the way down to like some of the micro skinnies, which are 16s. That's kind of like your Black Eagles and some of your Victories, and Easton also makes them too. Generally, those are used for 3D season because you're looking for something that's really light, still has the spine that can handle your draw length and your weight, because in 3D, you're shooting anywhere from some of the shorter shots could be 2 and 3 yards all the way out to you're shooting some targets that are pushing 100, 102, 103, and some challenge shots get out there to 140, 150 yards. So you want an arrow that's going to get there.
That's what I'm going into right now, getting set up for the Western Classic, the shoot in Redding. There's a couple targets in particular that I'm concerned about. There's, I believe it's an 88-yard elk scene, and then there's a 101, kind of the famous Redding target, 101-yard Bigfoot, giant, I think it's like 11, 12, something
it's big.
Feet tall. Yeah.
It's a big one. Well, then you've got the Standing Bears, which is across a canyon. That's probably my favorite target. But
what's
it's
the yardage on that?
I think it's 63 yards, but you're going across a canyon where there's generally some varying winds or breezes going on. You know, where you're standing might be in your face, but down at the target, it's going straight up the mountain type of thing. So it's an awesome shot. But then you've got your 70-something yard caribou, and so there are some really, really challenging shots there.
To add that level of difficulty to it, what I am realizing is I shoot an Easton Axis, just the standard 5mm hunting arrow. Hunting arrows are designed to be heavier grain per inch arrows.
Yeah,
heavier,
kinetics.
Right, kinetic so you energy, have the kinetic energy. Well, when I throw a 500 grain arrow through my indoor target setup or my target bow, I'm not getting to 101 yards without some magic. So the skinnier, lighter grain per inch target arrows for outdoor, the design philosophy, again, most people are shooting a 60-ish pound bow for target archery.
Yeah.
So they make them lighter grain per inch, so you have more feet per second. You can reach out there without, again, concocting some kind of weird sight setup, and they cut wind a little better. You're going from that indoor where you can get away with an extremely thick diameter shaft. There's no wind inside, so you don't care about environmentals at all. Now you take that to outside, and like you talked about with the Standing Bear target, you're shooting across a canyon. You want that narrow arrow that will cut through the wind and not throw you off a foot in any direction based on a gust.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And a lot of people get really tied up on the whole arrow thing. Now, granted, arrows are incredibly important. So a lot of folks have a separate bow for 3D and a separate bow for indoor, and others don't.
I'm in the others category.
Yes. So when you are transitioning from fatties to skinnies, you know, there's folks that have to change out their rest. Once you start changing your diameter, you're changing the angle of that arrow on the rest. So now your arrow's not going to be tuned.
Right.
Sometimes you got to make some fine-tune adjustments to convert your indoor bow, if you're using it for outdoor as well, get that thing to shoot properly with the new setup, with the new arrows.
And you're absolutely right. Yeah, I tend to focus right now. My entire focus, in fact, is on this arrow thing, getting an arrow that's light enough that I have the speed to get out there, all that. But you're absolutely right. As you're saying that, I'm thinking about, oh, geez, I have what's called a lizard tongue rest or a blade rest. And yeah, I'm going to have to think about that blade width on there, all that stuff. So this is, now is the time. I think we've got one more week at the indoor league we shoot at.
Well, and we also have the state Nevada Bowhunters Association State Indoor, which is the first shooting event for the big State of Nevada Championship belt buckle. That started February 1st and runs through the end of March, and different shops have different times that you can come in and you can shoot. So this weekend is at High Desert Archery in Reno, and then Impact Archery down in Vegas also has it this weekend, and Aces and Arrows has, I think they're splitting it up one day this weekend and one day next weekend, and then Wasting Arrows in Reno will have it the weekend of March 4th and 5th. And then Yerington is also having it. The Walker River Bowmen, theirs is coming up here this weekend or next weekend. You can get online onto Nevada Bowhunters Association, go into the calendar, and all of that information will be in the calendar. A lot of them, you can click the link in the calendar, and it'll take you to the registration for the indoor tournament. Pretty much that's it. Once this weekend hits for me, I am converting over to all of my 3D, the Winnemucca Indoor 3D Tournament at the Horse Arena, and that is coming up here in March. and then the Fallon Bowmen have their first annual indoor 3D tournament at the new shooting center there in Fallon. And that'll be the first weekend of April, April 1st and 2nd. That's the beginning of our 3D season. Again, it's all on the calendar on the Nevada Bowhunters page. It's also on our Instagram, which I do post on that for all of the shoots.
For people listening, if you're interested in coming out to some of the shoots, it's NevadaBowhunters.org is the website for that. And you just go, you click on the calendar, and that will show you all the upcoming competitions, all the shoots. This is what I'm excited about. I told David before the show, I said, man, I'm getting fed up. I can't look at dots inside anymore. My brain has switched gears to hunting, tag applications, all that stuff. So for me, this is what I'm really excited about.
I am too. I've been shooting dots for the last several months.
It gets tedious.
7 months. And, you know, it's great because it teaches you precision. The 3D season is probably one of my favorite. It's a great community, and there are so many shoots out there.
Stay tuned after the break here. We'll discuss some of the new, we'll call them fad arrows that are coming out from companies, but we'll get into arrow selection, arrow setup, what's out there, what's available, what you can find components for, etc. I wanted to give another shout out to Out West Buildings for sponsoring the show. Sincerely happy to have them on. Keep it tuned to 99.1 and 92.3 FM Talk.
All right, and we are back. So right now we're going to get ourselves into 3D archery arrows. So the question is, what is the most common arrow to use for 3D? And it's a good question because it depends on what type of tournament you're shooting. So if you're on the West Coast here and you're shooting orange dots, you know, the Redding Shoot, Cougar Mountain, some of the bigger 3D shoots, the Fresno Safari, you're going to be shooting primarily the orange dots on the animals. This generally brings up the question of transitioning into our skinny arrows, which are our 19 diameter, 16 to 19 diameter arrows. A lot of companies out there make them. You've got Black Eagle, you have Victory, you have Easton, you have Gold Tip. Choosing the right arrow is really up to your preference. One is your budget. Some of these arrows can go anywhere from roughly $75 a dozen fletched with tips and inserts to $800 for just raw shafts that you have to build yourself. You got to figure out your budget and then move from there. There's a lot of great arrows out there, and it really comes down to what works best for you, for your setup, for your bow, for your draw length, for your weight that you're shooting.
Back up real quick, David. A 19 diameter arrow, what is that?
So that's kind of like your standard diameter even for your hunting arrows. So it's the standard arrow when you go to a shop and you're looking at the arrows in the box.
Right.
Those, a lot of those are going to be generally 19 to 21 diameter arrows.
Five millimeter.
Roughly.
Because here's, I have my arrows that I like. I just stick with them until the company stops making them. And here's the thing that frustrates me. There's no standardized system. So I'll use Black Eagle, for instance. They've got micros, minis, whatever. That's what they call them. Easton does the 4 millimeter, 5 millimeter. They've
the
got
the
new 6.5 that we were talking about. That might be a fad. And then you go to like Gold Tip, you've got 0.166, 0.204, 0.246.
Yeah.
The standard measurement system. So I'm at that point where it's almost like I'll single out the 6.5 millimeter arrow. And I made the joke, I don't know if they're playing off the popularity of the 6.5 Creedmoor, 6.5 PRC. I don't know what this is, but It was in all the archery news, the ATA show that happened. It won some award.
Yeah, NABBA, all of them, yeah.
Yeah, and I don't know what is a 6.5? Why? What in the world is going on with arrow sizes? The 19 would be like a 5 mil, you said.
Yeah, roughly. So a lot of this is the science of an arrow. There's a lot of science and physics that goes into building these arrows. You've got the front of center. You've got the diameter, inside diameter. You've got the wall thickness. There's a lot of things. You can go down such a rabbit hole with arrows. You could probably put yourself in a loony bin by just trying to figure out every component of an arrow and testing those with your bow, the whole bit. My big thing with arrows is I take into consideration my draw length.
Okay.
How long my arrow is, where I'm cutting it. Because where you cut your arrow, you're not buying the shaft and leaving it full shaft at 34 inches and,
right.
launching that thing out of your bow. You're going to be cutting it at a certain distance from your rest. The shorter you cut your arrow, the stiffer the spine is going to end up being. So you're not going to take a 60-pound bow and go down and buy a 500-spine arrow because the probability of that thing blowing up in your hand or blowing up on your bow, just shooting like garbage, is very high. It's a very soft spine. You know, the higher number you go into the 500s, 600s, 900s, 1000s, those are really, really low-spined arrows, very flexible.
That's what I think my kid shoots, like a 1200 or something.
Yeah, one of my Olympic recurve shooters, we just set them up the other day, and the spine arrow that they're shooting is a 1000.
Right.
But they're shooting 27-pound Olympic recurve bow. So
they're not shooting a 70-pound compound hunting
bow.
No,
that would explode, and you'd be probably at the hospital.
Spine refers to the flexibility of an arrow, and this is where it gets real confusing.
Yeah, and that's like the thickness of the wall. So I look at that. I look at the poundage I'm shooting. I look at my draw length. I work back from there. I want a relatively light arrow because I'm shooting 60-ish, 62 pounds for 3D. And even a moderate, 7.5 grain per inch arrow for me is going to make 110 yards without a problem. It's going to have clearance. It's going to have no problem getting down the lane.
And grains per inch refers to the length of the arrow shaft, not necessarily grains per inch of draw length or
something like that. No, it's the weight of the arrow. For every inch of that arrow,
what is
7.5 grains. A lot of 3D shooters like to sit in the, right around the 400 grains, 350, 400 grain arrow. The main thing is making sure you have the spine that your bow can handle. Make sure that when you cut it, the length is okay, and that shoots good for you. Arrows are expensive. It's not like you can go and buy a bunch of different models and types. There's a lot of things that can drive you nuts. My best suggestion for folks that are just getting into this or wanting to really dive into it a little deeper is get to the local shops in the area here. Have really good technicians. They can talk to you about your bow, your setup, and they can guide you into the best arrow for the money that you want to spend on it.
And I would encourage people to ask about component selection for your arrows. Right off the bat, the 0.166, the super skinny micro stuff,
right?
It's a nightmare to find parts and pieces
for exactly.
them.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So make sure you can get the components and then narrow that window and select something.
That's a good point, Henry, because a couple years ago, I purchased a fad arrow. People were going to it. People loved it. It was called the Helix.
Okay.
Expensive arrow. I thought, oh man, I'm gonna go for this. This is going to be sweet. Well, I bought them, set some of them up. I still have, a half a dozen of the shafts. They quit making them. The fad disappeared pretty quick.
Yeah.
And now I can't find inserts.
Right.
So I have $150 in 6 arrow shafts that are basically enormous toothpicks for me because I can't find inserts for them.
Agreed. Back to the 6.5 thing, I actually have some for my recurve hunting bow, but I couldn't source brass inserts for it. Nobody was making a brass insert yet for it. I've gotten to that point with my arrow selection. selection. A criteria I have is basically, has it been on the market for at least 5 years? Is the size kind of standard? I've gotten to that point where the 5 mil, the Axis, that's why I like them. The availability's out there. The support is out there.
There's other factors as well. So when you start getting into some of these micro diameter shafts,
yes,
a big issue is clearance. So when that arrow leaves your string and goes across, if you're shooting a lizard tongue or something that's not a drop away, the smaller the diameter of the arrow, the closer those vanes are going to be to each other. There's all these little components that you need to kind of evaluate as you are trying to transition to a newer arrow. Several years ago, there was an arrow that people were raging about. Everyone had to have it. It was called the Deep Six. Several companies made them. People were buying them in droves. It was like the arrow to have.
They've all but disappeared now, haven't
completely.
They?
Completely. Yeah. I've got friends in the shooting world that have a dozen, and they can't find a component to save their lives. All the broadhead companies were starting to modify their broadheads to fit the Deep Sixes. Those are gone.
You had to get specific field points, all that. I remember
exactly.
That stuff.
So that's like Henry was saying, man, you got to look into what's the availability. Are these arrows so different that they have extreme custom components?
Yeah.
And if you do decide to go with it, say like, that's it. I love these arrows. I'm getting them. Well, then stock up on those components because if they disappear in 3 years and you're stuck with, you know, two dozen of these arrows and you're like, well, dang, I can't get broadheads for these. So what am I going to do with them? Stock up on the components, buy the broadheads, buy the insert.
And if you find yourself with four dozen arrows, four Rubbermaid bins full of components, because you stocked up on a fad arrow, conveniently, I know someone who's got a solution for you. It's Out West Buildings. Get in touch with my guy, Irvin, out there. He'll get you set up. So, and you can tell him, hey, I listened on the show. I bought into a fad arrow. He'll get you an entire archery shed built.
Yeah, a little on man cave.
On that note, thank you, everybody, for tuning in. Another Sunday wrapped up here. As always, if there are things you want us to cover,
which, or if you just have a question.
Or a question, absolutely. We did have somebody correct us on, I think it was a first come, first serve tags.
I think so.
Yeah, somebody got in touch and pointed out where we were wrong. Hey, we corrected it. We live off of that stuff. So please get in touch with us. You can email us at nvbackcountry@evansbroadcast.com or go on the Facebook page, like, subscribe. Thanks for joining us, everybody. Coming up at 11, Tom Gresham's Gun Talk. Don't change that dial position. Stay tuned to 99.1 and 92.3 FM Talk.